Morning. I still have three sheets of paper because I couldn't decide what to read this morning. I'm going to read a poem called Good Bones by Maggie Smith, one of my favorites. And I've changed the tenses because I'm no longer an active duty mother. I'm an empty nester, so I've changed the tenses to match that. Good Bones by Maggie Smith. Life is short, though I kept this for my children. Life is short, and I've shortened mine in 1,000 delicious, ill-advised ways. 1,000 deliciously ill-advised ways I've kept from my children. The world is at least 50% terrible, and that's a conservative estimate, though I kept this from my children. For every bird, there is a stone thrown at a bird. For every loved child, a child broken, bagged, sunk in a lake. Life is short, and the world is at least half terrible. And for every kind stranger, there is one who would break you, though I kept this from my children. I'm trying to sell them the world, or I tried to sell them the world. Any decent realtor walking you through a real shithole chirps on about the good bones. This place could be beautiful, right? You could make this place beautiful. Thanks.
Our next reader is Madeline.
I'm also going to read poems, three, but don't panic, two of them are really, really short. I thought we'd just have something about autumn with no meaning other than it's the autumn. I've always preferred the autumn to the spring, and the last poem I'm going to read is Keats, and it's the first lines of that, but I'm going to start with the short ones. The first one is by somebody called T.E. Holm, who died age 34 in 1917, and he wrote this in 1908. And it's supposed to be one of the very earliest examples of modern poetry. A touch of cold in the autumn night, I walked abroad and saw the ruddy moon lean over a hedge like a red-faced farmer. I did not stop to speak, but nodded, and round about were the wistful stars with white faces like town children. The next one is even shorter, and it's written, it's called November Night, and it's written by an American poet called Adelaide Crapsey, who died at 36 in 1914. Listen, with faint dry sound, like steps of passing ghosts, the leaves, frost-crisped, break from the trees and fall. These poets were all very young, and this one is Keats, and he was the youngest. He died, actually, he was born on the 31st of October, interestingly enough, 1795, and died aged 25 in 1821. But this one I was made to learn when I was in school, and I remember bits of it. Other bits aren't so good. To autumn. Season of mists and mellow fruitfulness, close bosom friend of the maturing sun, conspiring with him how to load and bless with fruit the vines that round the thatch eaves run, to bend with apples the mossed cottage trees and fill all fruit with ripeness to the core, to swell the gourd and plump the hazel shells with a sweet kernel, to set budding more and still more later flowers for the bees until they think warm days will never cease, for summer has o'erbrimmed their clammy cells. Who hath not seen thee oft amid thy store? Sometimes whoever seeks abroad may find thee sitting careless on a granary floor, thy hair soft lifted by the winnowing wind, or on a half-reaped furrow sound asleep, drowsed with the fume of poppies, while thy hook spares the next swath and all its twined flowers. And sometimes like a gleaner dost thou keep steady thy laden head across a brook, or by a cider press with patient look thou watchest the last oozings hours by hours. Where are the songs of spring? Aye, where are they? Think not of them. Thou hast thy music too, while barred clouds bloom from the soft dying day and touch the stubble plains with rosy hue. Then in a wailful choir the small gnats mourn among the river sallows, borne aloft or sinking as the light wind lives or dies. and full-grown lambs loud bleat from hilly bourn. Hedge crickets sing, and now with treble soft, the redbreast whistles from a garden croft, and gathering swallows twitter in the skies.
Thank you, Madeline. And just to embarrass Madeline, Friday was a special birthday for Madeline. So we're just going to have a very quick happy birthday for her. Andrew is our next reader, and he's going to read a piece about a cellist, and then we're going to hear the piece of music that's referred to in the poem.
Good morning. So my reading is from a book called Bittersweet, and it's by Susan Cain. And it's entitled, How to Turn Sorrow into Creativity, Beauty and Love. And really it's about something that we were familiar with in 1992 and is happening again in the world, and how maybe each of us can make a difference, because this one person made a difference. The Cellist of Sarajevo. One night, I dreamed that I was meeting my friend, a poet named Mariana, in Sarajevo, the city of love. I woke up confused. Sarajevo, a symbol of love? Weren't Bosnia and its capital, Sarajevo, the site of one of the bloodiest civil wars and ethnic cleansings of the 20th century? Then I remembered Vedran Samolovic, the cellist of Sarajevo. It's May 28, 1992, and Sarajevo is under siege. For centuries, Bosniaks, Croats, and Serbs have lived together in the city of street carts and pastry shops, gliding swans in parkland ponds, Ottoman mosques, and Eastern Orthodox cathedrals. A city of three religions, three peoples, yet until recently, no one paid too much attention to who was who. They knew, but they didn't know. They preferred to see one another as neighbors who met for coffee or kebabs, took classes at the same universities, sometimes got married and had children. But now civil war and ethnic cleansing of Bosnia's Muslims, men on the hills flanking the city have cut the electricity and water supply. The 1984 Olympic Stadium has burned down, its playing fields turned into makeshift graveyards. The apartment buildings are pockmarked from the mortar assaults. The traffic lights are broken, the streets are quiet. The only sound is the crackling of gunfire. Until this moment, when the strains of Albinoni's Adagio in G minor filled the pedestrian street outside a bombed out bakery. And that's the piece of music we're listening to. It's haunting, it's exquisite. It's infinitely sad. Vedran Samolovic, lead cellist of the Sarajevo Opera Orchestra, is playing it in honor of 22 people killed yesterday by a mortar shell as they lined up for bread. Samolovic was nearby when the shell exploded. He helped take care of the wounded. Now he's returned to the scene of carnage, dressed as if for a night at the opera house, in a formal white shirt and black tails. He sits amidst the rubble on a plastic white chair, his cello propped between his legs. The yearning notes of the adagio float up into the sky. All around him, the rifles fire, the shelling booms, the machine guns crackle. Samolovic keeps on playing. He'll do this for 22 days, one day for each person killed at the bakery. Somehow the bullets never touch him. This is a city built in a valley ringed by mountains from which snipers aim at starving citizens in search of bread. Some people wait for hours to cross the street, then dart across like hunted deer. But here's a man, sitting still in an open square, dressed in concert finery, as if he has all the time in the world. You ask me, am I crazy for playing the cello in a war zone, he says. Why don't you ask them if they're crazy for shelling Sarajevo? His gestures reverberate throughout the city, over the airwaves. Soon he'll find expression in a novel, a film. But before that, during the darkest days of the siege, Shumolovic will inspire other musicians to take to the streets with their own instruments. They don't play martial music to rouse the troops against the snipers or pop tunes to lift the people's spirits. They play the Albinoni. The destroyers attack with bombs and guns, and the musicians respond with the most bittersweet music they know. We're not combatants, call the violinists. We're not victims either at the violas. We're just humans, sing the cellos. Just humans, flawed and beautiful and aching for love. A few months later, the civil war and ethnic cleansing rage on, and the foreign correspondent, Alan Little, watches as a procession of 40,000 civilians emerge from a forest. They've been trudging through the woods for 48 hours straight, fleeing an attack. Among them is an 80-year-old man. He looks desperate, exhausted. The man approaches Little, and Little asks whether he's seen his and asks Little if he's seen his wife. They were separated during the long march, the man says. Little hasn't seen her, but the journalist asks whether the man wouldn't mind identifying himself as either Muslim or Croat. And the man's answer, Little says years later in a gorgeous BBC segment, shames him even now as he recalls it across the decades. I am, said the old man, a musician.
Our next reader is Noli.
Good morning, everyone. I'm going to read from one of the older Thich Nhat Hanh books. He first published this book in 1988, and he was one of the first people to bring mindfulness to the West. He also established a place called Plum Village in France, where you can go on retreats for mindfulness, etc. So the heading of this is Taking Care of the Apple Tree in Your Yard. As we sit down next to a stream, we can listen to its laughter and watch its sparkling waters, noticing the pebbles glistening and the fresh green plants nearby. And we may be overcome with happiness. We are one with the stream's freshness, purity, and clarity. But in just an instant, we may find we've had enough. Our heart is troubled, and we think of other things. We are no longer at one with the stream. It is of no use to sit in a peaceful forest if our mind is lost in the city. When we live with a child or a friend, their freshness and warmth can relax us. But if our heart is not with them, their precious presence is neglected and they no longer exist. We must be aware of them to appreciate their value, to allow them to be our happiness. If through carelessness and forgetfulness we become dissatisfied with them and begin asking too much of them or reprimanding them, we will lose them. Only after they are gone will we realize their preciousness and feel regret. But once they are gone, all our regrets are in vain. Around us, life bursts forth with miracles. A glass of water, a ray of sunshine, a leaf, a caterpillar, a flower, laughter, raindrops. If you live in awareness, it is easy to see miracles everywhere. Each human being is a multiplicity of miracles. Eyes that see thousands of colors, shapes, and forms. Ears that hear a bee flying or a thunderclap. A brain that ponders a speck of dust as easily as the entire cosmos. A heart that beats in rhythm with the heartbeat of all beings. When we are tired and feel discouraged by life's daily struggles, we may not notice these miracles, but they are always there. Have a look at the apple tree in your yard. Look at it with complete attention. It is truly a miracle. If you notice it, you will take good care of it. And you too are part of its miraculousness. Even after caring for it for only a week, its leaves are already greener and shinier. It is exactly the same with people who are around you. Under the influence of awareness, you become more attentive, understanding, and loving. And your presence not only nourishes you and makes you lovelier, it enhances them as well. Our entire society can be changed by one person's peaceful.
Liz has a reading.
This reading is an abridged version of a newspaper article written by Colin McCann at the start of the Israel-Hamas conflict. Like most of us, I didn't know what to say, not to my family, not to my colleagues, not myself. So early on Monday morning, I texted my friends, Bassam Aramin and Rami Elhanan, whom I had written about in my novel, A Paragon, asking them how they were doing in the terrible turmoil that unfolded over the weekend. One is Palestinian, the other is Israeli. One lives in Jericho, the other in Haifa. Having both lost their daughters to violence, they live in the Holy Land of grief. I mentioned to them that I thought my speechlessness was a statement in itself. This was an obvious cop-out on my behalf, and I knew it. I went on to ask them, how are they responding? Bassam came back to me within a half an hour. He quoted a Mahmoud Darwish poem. Tomorrow the war will end. The leaders will shake hands. The old woman will keep waiting for her martyred son. The girl will wait for her beloved husband. And those children will wait for their hero father. I don't know who sold our homeland, but I saw who paid the price. Within 1 minute, Rami, his Israeli friend, had sent a teardrop emoji. The responses struck me deeply. They were simple, but then again, in this particular conflict, simplicity is an achievement. Bassam was saying that the war will end. Peace, in his eyes, is an inevitability. Time changes all things. Who believed that 20 years after the Holocaust, there could be an Israeli embassy in Berlin and a German embassy in Tel Aviv? Who dreamt of the Berlin Wall coming down? Who thought that there would be relative quiet in the streets of Belfast? Bassam is not a sentimental man. He spent 7 years in Israeli prisons. He lost his cherished daughter to an Israeli bullet. He is, however, a man who fits into the Gramscian construct of being a pessimist of the intellect and an optimist of the will. In other words, these are the darkest times, but it is the job of Bassam to believe there is a possible change lurking in the beyond. To refuse to believe so would be to die. In some ways, he is cursed by hope. Rami, too, is cursed by his sense of hope. As an Israeli, he is aware that the occupation has corrupted his country. His heart breaks for all, Israeli, Palestinian, or others, who are forced to visit his country of grief. Rami and Bassam have a construct when they travel the world together talking about their plight. We don't need to love each other, they say. We don't even need to like each other, although we hope we could. But the one thing we do need to do to prevent us speaking from 6 feet underground is to understand one another. This is the most crucial thing. We need to know one another. It's not enough, but it's something.
Robin has a reading.
Good morning. When I was a very young boy and an altar boy, my parish priest was a bishop and my parish church was a cathedral, and we had long, long ceremonies and all that. And I always remember there was a suggestion at the beginning for shorter versions, read in italics. And you know, I'm sure you all know, they never did. So this reading I have today, which is by Good Vibes, Good Life by Vex King, it's an article on gratitude. I decided I would italicize it. I'm not even sure if there's such a word, but I'm going to edit it in order to make it short enough for us here, I hope, without losing the substance. So, being thankful is one of the simplest and yet most powerful habits you can cultivate. By counting your blessings daily, you can begin to condition your mind to look for the good in everything around you. Soon enough, you will unconsciously begin to see the bright side of things and feel better about life. You can't feel bad when you're feeling thankful. As simple as showing gratitude sounds, most people struggle with it. It's much easier to focus on burdens than on gifts, to devote your attention to the things you don't have rather than the things you do have. I was once studying some of the most successful individuals on this planet, and one phrase really struck me: greatness starts with being grateful. I didn't think too much of it at the time, but as I've grown older, I've begun to understand its value. I realized that you can't feel joy without being thankful. Being thankful is a vital component of happiness. Furthermore, by expressing gratitude, we not only transform our vibrational state to become more magnetic to the good things, but we also become able to put things into perspective. We go through each day constantly comparing ourselves to others, and most of us rarely acknowledge that we have what others may desire. We also tend to compare ourselves to those we consider more fortunate, rather than those who are less fortunate. Just think of the amount of people who have to live through war on a daily basis, but who are completely safe from such troubles, and many more that we hear about in the news. It's easy to say thanks without really meaning it. The key to showing gratitude is to feel thankful. When practicing gratitude, imagine how difficult your life would be without that particular thing you're showing thanks for. It will produce strong feelings and emotions, and this is how you can get into a powerful state of gratitude. Remember, there might be many things in the world that are going wrong, yet there are absolutely many things in the world that are going right. The more you count your blessings, the more blessings you'll have to count. Too many of us direct our energy towards our fears. I'm not saying your problems don't exist, but try instead to focus your energy on solutions to these problems. The universe is abundant in all areas. The illusion of fear is the only limitation we have.
I think we've time for another reader. Janet, would you like to read?
Good morning, everybody. It might be a little simplistic, but I'm quite upset at what is happening in the world. And in my simplistic attempt to understand it, I think that when people lose sight of the very essence of them and their very being, there's trouble ahead. I know there are many reasons for this happening, but the consequences of losing sight of your essence and your being are detrimental. I'm reading out of Sister Stan's book. It's titled Finding Peace, and I'm going to read a few of the words put together by a man called Liam O'Moonlay, excuse the pronunciation, and he is a band member in the Hothouse Flowers. He speaks of his art, and he speaks of his sense of being, and I found it very comforting. Every time I cross the threshold of where I eat and sleep, out into the air and the sky, I feel something. I'll just push this down a bit. My body feels it. It is as if the stars and the sky connect with what is in me. In autumn, the smell of fallen leaves deepens the experience of breathing for me. I put one foot ahead of the other, as did my people and their people before them. I cease the following of any train of thought, but rather allow the thought be and fade. The light of the morning sun feels vivid and nourishing to my being, and I feel buoyed by the light. I walk at an easy pace, slow and even. This has been a great source of peace for me, to bear witness to the coming of the day as a being of the day. Sometimes at night, in winter, when I walk, I let go of my defense against the cold. I let the cold in, and I become the night. My hands by my side feel the cold, and my body no longer feels it as something to run from. I have paint, ink, charcoal, and paper. Often by the fire at home, I will play with the color and the nature of the materials. I let them lead, then I might lead, then they lead again, a dance of creation. I have no goal but to allow a balance between how I feel, what I see, what I feel, and how I see. 2 days later, perhaps, I will take great pleasure at gazing at the work. I might gaze at the sky and the clouds. There are many words for God, and many stories and ways to adore him. I feel blessed to have the air coursing through me, to have the billions of miracles it takes for me to be here, occurring as I write and as you listen.